This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Hello, everybody, and welcome again to another BristolCon Fringe reading. Thank you ever so much for braving the floods and whatever to make it here tonight. Sadly, Scott Lewis can't be here. The British government has put up the Scott signal, and he had to don his superhero costume and head down to Somerset to rescue people from the waves and whatever. So Scott hopefully will be reading for us at some time in the near future. But we do have something rather exciting tonight. Well, it's rather exciting for me. We have a book. We have actual copies of Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion, which arrived in the city last week and are available for purchase from Joe. Or if you are contributors, they're available for collection if you're a free contributor copy as well. I was hoping we would have a proof of the hardcover today as well. It was dispatched from the printers on Friday, but it's obviously got lost in the waters along the way. It'll doubtless turn up tomorrow. But we'll get there eventually. And we are in the process of organising some launch events, which I shall tell you about later. But first of all, because Scott isn't here, we have prevailed upon one of the contributors to the book to actually give us a brief reading. And Kenshin has very kindly volunteered. So Ken, would you like to come take stand?
Kenshin, I'm pleased to meet you. You probably know me somewhere, but... And this is, indeed, Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion, a magnificent anthology of stories centering on steampunk around the Bristol area, and you should all read it because it is marvellous. This is, well, I'll read you some of my story, which kicks the whole thing off, and I was rather irrationally pleased about that. It's lovely to see you being accepted. It's my first professionally published piece of work, and first in the book as well, and you think, that's kind of propitious if you believe in stupid superstitions, as I occasionally do. But anyway, without no more ado, might as well carry on and give it to you. This is Case of the Vapors by Kenshin. Body snatching. I paused as I raised and matched my cigarette. That's unusual. Resurrectionism is pretty much unheard of in these enlightened times. It had given me pause. I felt a welcome heat at my fingertips, applied the flame to the fag and shook it out. So why bring it to me? Wouldn't the police be more obvious? Mr. Bowyer, this is a private matter. A valuable possession has been stolen. That is very much my household's concern. We'd like this affair resolved with a minimum of bureaucratic interference, and we're prepared to pay you handsomely. She wafted smoke from her own cigarette elegantly away with velvet gloved hand. A small woman in her early 20s. Slender almost to the point of skinniness, but not unattractive, with a sharp, intelligent pair of green eyes and a mop of red hair that carefully in place. Not the usual sort of customer, altogether too well spoken, too well dressed, and too wealthy. Mrs. Willems, if you pardon my saying so, it's rare to find anyone who describes a slave's corpse as a valuable possession. But this man was one of our most trusted servants, a highly educated and much valued family member, and he was an extremely expensive vapor. Fluent in 8 languages, well-versed in etiquette, expert on champagnes, and an experienced chef in schools from the Orient and the Mediterranean. My husband and I are most anxious to discover why someone decides to break into his sarcophagus on our own grounds and remove his body for purposes unknown. See, a family affair as it were. Well, if you pique my interests, I'll investigate for you. My fee is fixed at 10 guineas a day plus expenses. That's a high price. It's a high-risk occupation. I can imagine the constant risk of eviction. I'm the businessman, Mrs. Willems, and that's my price. Done. She shot out her hand, gripped mine, and shook it quickly and firmly. Start as soon as you're ready. The ball was awash with the best quality foods, wines, and beers. I was in no hurry to start immediately, and I told her so. She inclined her head graciously. Then at least have a good look around at this gathering. It seems highly likely that a member of this household was key to the success of the fifth. It was carried out undetected, after all. Mrs. Willems didn't beat about the bush. I rather liked her. Causing only to snag a fresh stout from a passing vapour flunky, his whirring clockwork implants freshly polished against his dark skin and crisp linens, and mingle as unobtrusively as I could. The gathering was as genuinely vacuous as it was large. There weren't many unpleasant individuals, but the impression that my meanderings gave me was that throng more interested in the latest fashions in gowns, snuff, and hunting horses than it was in the more pressing issues of the day. I kept a pleasantly neutral expression. After all, they were at worst annoying, and that still wasn't a crime to my knowledge. A knot of revellers was gathered around the stage discreetly tucked to one side. On the low dice, a string quartet before which Strauss walked with practiced mediocrity, much technique, little feeling. At centre stage, a dancing pair of vapours, one man, one woman, were whirling gracefully, both decked out in incongruously oriental silks. They were clearly more expensive than warm, more than usually physically attractive, and their steam-driven workings were clearly designed for aesthetics as much as practicality, looking more like moving jewellery against their smooth brown faces and wrists than the clanking chunks of metal of the more common slave, clockwork servant. I had problems with that meanly mouthed phrase. It suggested an automaton out of Verne or Wells, rather than the blunt synthesis of metal and invariably black flesh of the actuality. However delicately the workings may be fashioned, we were still left looking at somebody who had been forced to be transformed purely for the sake of improving their work. The couple passed gracefully back and forth. The music swirled and fluttered as it was meant to. Then the man stopped in his tracks. The music stuttered on for a few bars and then stopped. A look of anger crossed the man's calm features. He spun on his heel, snatched a violin from a startled musician and raised it like a club. And then he froze in his tracks. A fine but clear mist of steam, far greater than the usual gentle hissing caused by the everyday mechanical workings of the average vapour, gushed from the bowels of his temples. His face creased into a mask of agony. He sank awkwardly to his knees while his partner looked on in dismay. The quiet that had suddenly settled over this corner of the room was broken by a harsh bray of laughter. Looks like the silly ass has got an attack of the vapours. The humorist was Mrs. Willen's husband, Anthony, a stocky man in his mid-thirties with a close-cropped skull and incipient jowls, a regular toad of Toad Hall. I'd taken an irrational distaste to him on the first introduction. Now I realise that my instincts had been sound. The man was a school bully made good. Nevertheless, his pip, an old joke which had first been recorded in Punch some 2 years ago, set that corner of the room on a roar as the gathering seized gratefully on the chance to make light of the situation. It was clear what had happened. The Staunton Limiter, more commonly known as the Clockwork Conscience, had activated. This ingenious little device is fitted as standard in any vapour required to retain any degree of their higher functions. Should the host think any impure thoughts of rebellion or anything above mild and momentary discontent, then it detected changes in the body chemistry and mechanically caused a powerful, debilitating migraine. As Staunton himself had said when introducing this boon to the gentlemen of the press, it's like to have half Nelson put on the old brain. People like Staunton made me uncomfortably glad to be white. I looked away at the rest of the room and saw that Anthony's beloved Jessica had a look of cold disdain on her face, and it seemed aimed at her husband. Interesting. As the party settled back into frolic and laughter, and the stricken vapour had been quietly ushered away to recover, I quietly drew the husband and wife to one side. I asked them to also bring over their major domo, who could be the vapour who had been providing my drinks. A distinguished middle-aged man who was introduced to me as Joshua. I needed all of them to set up my terms. I've agreed to take on this investigation. My payments have already been agreed. At this, an ugly flush suffused Anthony's face, who obviously preferred to be the man who made the deals. But I will need complete access to this house and its grounds. If possible, I prefer to be left with my own devices until I've reached my solution. Also, I prefer to take a look at the scene of the crime right now. The hour was late, but a lantern was found, and Jessica and Joshua escorted me across the landscape grounds to a small marble building below an ancient yew tree. Anthony followed as far as the end of the terrace, then cheerfully stayed there and gazed after us, seemingly more interested in his champagne. Joshua carefully opened the door and handed me the light. The mistress and I will stay here. Nothing has been disturbed since we found out. I thanked him and stepped inside. Warm shadows engulfed me, and the glow of the lantern disclosed the open sarcophagus. I stepped over it and examined it carefully. The first thing that I noticed was it had been opened neatly, no sign of forcing. That tended to support the theory of this being an inside job. The winding sheet had been carefully removed and folded. I read the inscription. Tobias Clayton, true and faithful servant, 1818-1888. Your labour's over. Rest at peace with the Lord. There seemed to be little else of interest when I was walking around the sarcophagus to exit, when my foot struck something. I stooped, and found myself looking at a pendant. Small, delicate, and very beautiful. A clear, multifaceted stone shone its golden housing. I pocketed it discreetly and left. Having been escorted back to the house, I thanked my host and took my leave, picking up one of Anthony's business cards from the hallway on a whim. As I walked home to my rooms in Redland, I turned matters over in my mind. The thing that struck me most was that this seemed set to be an extremely easy case to solve. The number of plausible suspects was small. Those members of the widow's household had access to the grounds and the means and will to remove a body. The real mystery, why? What advantage did anyone stand to gain from stealing the corpse of the vapor? I've had the trinket in my pocket. Tomorrow morning, I had some visits to make to the city centre with some questions to ask. The next day dawned warm and sunny. I dealt with a minor hangover by dosing it needlessly with coffee and cigarettes, shaved and dressed, and by 11 was walking with some semblance of wakefulness and good humour to the centre of Bristol. Business falling before pleasure, I made my first call into a small pawnbroker's on Hobbs Lane. Howard Gold greeted me cheery as the shop bell rang. Good morning, Dan. What can I do for you this fine day? I gazed at the short, wild-haired septuagenarian with affection. Howard and his money-lending abilities had kept me afloat during some very lean periods for a Bristolian man having gifts of prestige of business. Also, while he was generally friendly to his clientele, when it came to valuations, he had an intellect as vast and cool as any Martian's. And that was exactly what I needed right now. I reached into my pocket, drew out the pendant, and placed it squarely in front of him on the counter. I'd like to know how much we get for this, if you don't mind. My tone had been light, playful, deliberately jocular. But Howard's reaction was anything but. It was as if a switch had been thrown. In an instant, he was leaning forward to examine the jewelry with an expression composed of equal parts amazement and cold intensity. Where did he get this? His voice was blunt, almost brutally businesslike. Found it when I was taking a constitutional. I tried to keep my voice airy. I've never seen Howard react like this, and to be honest, it unnerved me a little. Anyway, as I was saying, how much is it worth? Howard had reached into a drawer and produced a loop, which he unhesitatingly screwed into his eye. Firing up an oil lamp, he lifted the pendant close to the light. Almost offhandedly, he muttered, "If I gave you an honest loan for this one, then I'd bankrupt myself." I shut up and let him carry on with his examination. After much careful gazing, rifling through various volumes and the occasional low whistle, he straightened up. "Well, that's a genuine diamond, extremely pure. Not many carats, too small for that, but very valuable. Quite exquisitely cut, done by a real expert. The housing on the chain of hallmark gold, definite 24-carat stuff. It's not going to give the Kalinan any sleep this night, but it is worth a tidy sum. Somebody like yourself could probably rest their life very comfortably in the proceeds of this. Definitely somewhere in the region of £5,000, maybe more, the property of a lady of considerable wealth. You're lucky. If I were 30 years younger and you didn't habitually carry a firearm, you might just be a corpse by now. You sure you didn't steal it?" He did, at least, when he said that. "No, Howard, I really did find it. But honesty is a harsh mistress. I think that I'd better return it to its rightful owner, if I can find her. And no, I'm sorry, but you can't have it." I said half a crown across the counter. "But have a large drink on me. Helps to drown large sorrows." Howard smiled and bade me a good day. 15 minutes later, I was sitting in a private club off of King Street, holding a pint of porter and pondering. The lunchtime crowd hadn't appeared yet, so it was just me, the barman, and my own thoughts. The conclusion was obvious. The pendant belonged to Mrs. Jessica Willens, wife of, as his business card informed me, renowned importer and exporter Mr. Anthony Willens. So Howard had ended up at a crime scene. That was easy as well. Mrs. Jessica Willens was involved in the crime, which again returned me to the big mystery. Why should she, or anybody else, want to steal their vapor, and why this particular one? I decided that a brisk stroll might aid my detective processes. I walked down the last of my cheese roll, swallowed the last of the beer, and left a fresh gasp as I walked out the door, and headed through the welcome leafy shade of Queen Square towards the harbour side, and the head office of Willens Universal Import and Export. We almost had to shout to make ourselves heard above the clamour of voices and the clangour of machinery. Trying to find out more about Anthony's wife was proving surprisingly easy. The man himself was ready to talk and to denigrate. "Dan, I had to marry her. Literally went round to her parents after I got her preggers, and what did they do? Insisted that I marry her. Of course, she lost a child, far too young and frail for motherhood anyway, but it didn't alter the fact that she was married to me. She threw herself into all sorts of charitable work, sits on several committees for reforms of one sort or another. To be frank, I'd be glad to be short of her. She was good for a tumble, but if scrawny, but as a wife, she's a sanctimonious sourpuss." I took a deep breath and banished an image of a morning star impacting forcefully against the villain's skull. I'd only wanted to learn a little more about his wife, but I learned enough about the husband to last me a lifetime. No amount of pale fellow well met could disguise the fundamental callous self-interest of the man. I felt glad that I hadn't returned her pendant to him. We continued to stroll along the busy harbour side. All around us, various overseers were supervising vapors as they lumbered to and fro, shifting heavy cargoes on and off ships and constructing basic stores and sheds. These vapors had none of the grace of those that ensured the smooth running of the villain's estate. Their implants were far more sturdy, far more obvious. Great pistons pumped along their limbs, emitting thick clouds of steam. They were all larger and stronger than average, chosen for heavy work, and then made more capable of doing so. None of them warranted the expense of a copper of conscience. Instead, every one of their foreheads bore the signs of brain surgery. Some scars were still fresh and even had large functional stitches. Others had faded to greyish seams, like scratches on slate. None of them were wearing much in the way of safety clothing, I commented. Isn't work like this potentially very dangerous? Williams waved the observational wave and wafted his huge cigar. Well, why bother? Cheap labour, easily enough replaced. If one of them takes a crate to the noggin or gets crushed under a falling girder, then there's plenty more to take his place. Easier than forking out a bundle of safety nonsense. Barely taking this in when I heard an ominous creaking noise. Looking up, I saw a large pallet of goods being loaded to the quay was barely hanging in the grip of a hawser. A hawser that was fraying fast. Directly over one oblivious vapour who was hunched down and tying his heavy work boots. I looked at a forward instinctively, barely aware of Willen's surprised yell from behind me. As I did so, the overloaded rope snapped with a pistol shot crack. I'm not the strongest of men, nor the heaviest, but I'm no lightweight either. And if faith can move mountains, then a fast-moving human body can shift a somewhat larger one. I cannoned into the vapour, feeling as though sprawling awkwardly, but luckily several feet clear of the plummeting pallet, which hit the quay with a bottom thump, splintering badly as crates of ale jolted to the ground and shattered. As we turned to our feet, I heard the heavy sound of my own shocked breath. Willem strode swiftly but calmly over to us. I swallowed hard and turned my attention to the vapour. Thankfully, like myself, the only damage had been done to his clothing. Are you all right? His voice rumbled like coal into a cellar. Yes, I'm okay. Willem took me by the arm and drew me slightly to one side. Don't be so bloody sentimental, he hissed. Having assured himself that I was uninjured, he passed me a hip flask. I took a careful swallow of brandy, and he promptly grabbed it back, seeming and pocketing it before turning to the vapour. Well, thank Mr. Bowyer, there's a good lad. I extended my hand swiftly to the towering figure. Just Dan. What's your name? He spoke slowly, carefully. My name, Robert. Thanks, Just Dan. His huge paw engulfed my hand, and his eyes met mine. He squeezed hard, painfully in fact, and I bit back on his comfort, smiled, and gripped his hand. My pleasure, Robert. Robert nodded slowly. He opened his mouth gradually as if to add more, but Glynn's tugged briskly on my sleeve and pulled me away. Get that mess cleared up, he snapped at the overseer. Then a bald, chummy grin spread over his florid face. Is there anything else that I can do for you, Mr. Barrier? I smiled back with all the protest that I could muster. Not right now, Mr. Williams, but I would like to visit your house again. Is your wife likely to be at home to visit us? I'd like to ask her a few questions too. Of course she is. Probably writing letters to one of her blessed charities. She must likely appreciate a visitor. Make a nice change for her to see somebody other than the staff. I left him stumbling back to his side office. Looking down at my torn and dirty garments, I decided to detour by my lodgings first. Standards, after all, are there to be maintained. I went towards Robert, but he turned back to his labours. Shrugging, I went on my way. Freshly changed and somewhat calmer, I strode the gravel drive to the main door of the grand house on Clifton Downs, thoughts chasing each other through my mind. Mrs. Jessica Willems, a young woman taken for granted but arguably abused by her husband, who had lost a child very early, but turned her energies into supporting a host of good causes. They were under very valuable pendants. They had presumably been involved in Newman Tobias' corpse under cover of darkness to bear. Sometimes inspiration simply strikes you hard, and then the obvious solution. Rather than move the body over a long distance, we could store it for a fair period of time in a suitably temperate place, such as one of the many rooms in a very large house where your own husband wouldn't even deign to go. I had no hard evidence, but it felt right. At that moment, I was prepared to wager that the corpse had been hidden away inside the Willems' house itself. And following on the heels of that came another thought. The pendant had been completely undamaged. The chain hadn't been broken. It had been neatly unfastened. Now, maybe if Mrs. Williams had been involved in moving the body, she'd removed it at some point, perhaps to avoid entanglement. Maybe she'd meant to pocket it and missed it in her preoccupation with the task at hand and dropped it unawares. Or perhaps she'd left it there intentionally. Perhaps she was hoping to be recognised as a culprit by me. And why should she want that? If you want to find out, you need to read the rest of the story.
Oh, thank you very much, Ken. Now, for a first public reading, I think that was absolutely brilliant. Well done, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we'll have a short break now so that people can replenish their glasses, order food if they want, pop off to the loo or whatever, and we'll resume in about 5 minutes' time with Mr. Jonathan Pinnock.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.